Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. And as you probably know, our work in the world is to use facts to demonstrate that we are living unsustainably and overdrawing our accounts economically with fossil fuel, energy sources, and most critically, environmentally. And because this message is so tricky to convey under the easiest of circumstances, we consciously avoid territory that is shaped and guarded by beliefs. Fortunately, we understand this and we manage to reach a lot of people. But one of the areas, one of the belief-saturated areas that we studiously avoid is partisan politics, and not just because of the role of partisan beliefs in derailing rational conversation about the various predicaments we face, but because of our own belief that there happen to be very few differences between the two main parties, as both primarily serve corporate and other special interests at the expense of the people they allegedly serve, the environment, and, well, the future. And we're not alone. Congressional approval ratings hit an all-time new low in the last Gallup poll for November 2013, plummeting the single digits with a woeful reading of just 9%. And just as bad, summing up eight different polls on the question of whether the country is on the right track or the wrong track, at 68%, more than two-thirds of Americans believe we're on the wrong track. So it's very rare that we wade into these waters, and doubly rare for us to single out a specific politician or political candidate to talk to. But today, we're going to do just that because one has emerged that really stands apart from the crowd. California has 53 congressional districts, and the 33rd is in Los Angeles, largely nestled between Routes 5 and 405. And running for that seat is today's guest, Marianne Williamson, an internationally acclaimed author, lecturer, and thought leader. Six of her 10 published books have been on the New York Times bestsellers list. Four of these have been number one bestsellers over the years, and she has lectured to hundreds of thousands of people in the United States and abroad. She has many credentials, too many to list. Let's just say she's highly accomplished and very well-spoken. Marianne, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to jump right in your own words. Why are you running for Congress?
Well, I'm running for Congress because of something that you yourself stated, and that's that our politics are driven by two major political parties who are both beholden more to corporate interests than to the American people, and that represents nothing short of the dismantling of our democracy.
And these corporate interests, of course, they do have a stranglehold on our system at this point in time. How do you propose to go about changing that dynamic?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is to admit what will not change it. And what will not change it is looking to either of the major political parties to deliver us from that condition, given that both of them are so locked into it. Both of them are so beholden to that interest, particularly since the Citizens United case. So if they, in order to get elected and stay elected, have to do the bidding, as they so often do, of these corporate interests, then if there's going to be any serious pattern interruption here, it will come from us, the people. And that's why conversations like this, particularly whether it's you and your group, me and many people I know, and all people all around the country who are looking more and more in an independent direction. And also, I think it's significant to know not only how many people are realizing that looking to the political status quo to deliver us from this condition is naive at best, given that they created it in so many cases. I think also more and more Americans are looking at the fact that throughout the narrative of American history, the major movements, social movements forward with political consequences did not emerge from major political parties, whether it was abolition or women's suffrage or the civil rights movement. So we're really part of a historical lineage of what happens when the people of the United States recognize that our government is swerving away from its basic role of balancing the issues of individual liberty with a concern for the common good, and it's time for the American people to do an intervention.
Intervention. Well, I certainly love that, and I do agree with your assessment that all changes to the status quo seem to have been brought kicking and screaming from the outside in, and many of them we count as our best successes. So it is time for a new direction, and it's not just economically, I'm sure you're familiar with so many people, it's not just the 99%, let's call it the 99.8%, really feel like this is not working in our best interest at this point in time. So economically, we've got that, but on other subjects as well, there are a lot of reasons that the people I talk to are very concerned about the direction we're heading in. And so it transcends, I think, needing a few tweaks and wiggles here and there and maybe a couple of new votes. We really need to do things in a fundamentally different way, which includes things for the bulk of the people. How would you approach that?
Well, first of all, let's point out that the two are connected. You know, anytime you have even the most subtle economic tyranny, you're going to have an analogous situation elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as you allow for economic injustice, don't be surprised that there are other forms of political injustice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, first of all, important. If you allow the unholy alliance between government and moneyed interests to protect their perch when it has to do with economic power, it is not surprising to see that there will be the same drive to protect that perch in terms of political power. So that's why you see a connection between unfair banking policies, unfair tax policies, and unfair trade policies, even unfair criminal justice policies. It's all connected. The knee bone is connected to the thigh bone there. So whether it's something like economic justice because of the dominance, the unfair influence wielded by the corporate sector in terms of tax and banking, or the NSA spying, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the National Defense Authorization Act, anytime you're giving power in general to any one group, they're going to wield it within every context that they possibly can.
Indeed, they will, and they have. And you've just run down a whole litany of things from the way that the trade structure is working primarily for certain interests against others. But most importantly, a big hot button for myself and many of our listeners are the loss of civil liberties, which has been especially egregious over the past few number of years, especially with the NSA spying revelations. So this idea then that we the people need to, I guess, assume some of the power back, how do you propose that we go about doing that?
One area where I think you and I would see things in, I think, a complementary way, but with a slightly different focus, because at the beginning of this interview you talked about rationality and facts. But I think that there's a tremendous psychological element here. And just as in physical healing, it's not nothing. It's not metaphor. It's not symbol. It's actual and it's literal, and it has to do with how people behave. What has happened is a kind of mesmerization of the American people, where politics itself has been turned into a spectator sport. And that's really an issue here. Someone like yourself, someone like the people who normally listen to you, people like myself and the people who listen to me, are very aware that we need to do something. Our biggest problem, I believe, is how many Americans have not yet gotten to that point. They are waking up to realizing how severe the issue is. I do believe that that's happening. People are waking up to recognize how severe the problem is, but there's a very deep psychological issue here, because we were raised to believe that if things got too unfair, the government would fix it. We are now having to face the fact that the government is often on the side of the perpetrator. They are often now on the side of those who would encroach upon our rights. Now, that produces a lot of fear in people.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a child having to face the fact that I'm not sure I can trust mommy and daddy. And so there's a lot of psychological dismantling of an old belief system that has to occur before people will add their energy and their behavioral patterns to an effort to fix the problem. And this is in a way child psychology, but in a way it's also adult psychology when you're talking about, you know, I was reading a book recently about the abolitionist movement. And the book was about the years that it took of people coming individual by individual to understand how severe the problem was. So first of all, people have to wake up. And this included, it was interesting because it included Southern abolitionists as well. Imagine what it would be like to be born into a slave-owning family and to realize as a child, basically, you know, we have slaves in this house. There's evil here. And my whole community is evil. And this whole thing is evil. So people would go one of two ways, either buy into it because it's too difficult not to, or go through the often very painful process of knowing, in order for me to stand against this, I have to split from my family, from the people who love me, and everything I know. So this book was interesting because it was talking about, you really got clear about all the layers of human understanding that preceded the abolitionist movement actually bursting into an actual political movement that changed things on an external level. And so I think that that's what's happening right now. The first thing is for more people to understand what's happened, to understand that we don't need to be scared, we just need to become active, to understand that this is what has happened before in history, that in fact this is what happens whenever systems of great money and great power are able to wield the kind of power that they have been able to wield over the last few decades with as much acquiescence from the people as they have received and as much disengagement on the part of so many people. So that what's happened is that the thief has entered the house of democracy and are, through all these different policies, trade policies, banking policies, trade policies, tax policies, and all these civil liberties issues you and I are talking about, it's like we're saying, oh my goodness, what happened to our democracy? But I also think it's important for us to realize that we left the doors open and we left the windows open. So what I see in people is a lot of, you know, people having to work out what's happened here so that they are not afraid to trust the voices like yours, like mine, saying this is unacceptable and we have to change this, and to know that we are actually part of the great historical lineage, whether it was abolitionists or civil rights or movement or women's suffrage who said, no, we're going back to democracy, we're going to embody democracy, we're going to manifest democracy, and we're going to do whatever it takes to give this evolutionary movement political heft. I mean, in 1776, Americans repudiated an aristocratic system in 1776. And we need to do it again, this time not with a revolution, obviously, but with an evolutionary movement with real political heft. And that's what I see happening here.
I love the idea of an evolutionary movement, particularly if we have to look in the mirror and say, we've met the enemy, he is us. And I see from my perch that our narrative has really broken down. You mentioned the democratic narrative, the one that we learn about in grade school. This is how it works. It's of the people, by the people, for the people. You grow up. Particularly in our current era, and you say, maybe that's not exactly how that's working, and it's hard to reconcile that. We're having a complete breakdown in our monetary narrative as well. For the average person listening to this, money is a very real substance. You either have it or you don't. And in our society, if you don't have it, life can be very, very difficult. And we see more and more of that money accumulating to fewer and fewer hands. And meanwhile, the Federal Reserve is busy printing, well, now $75 billion a month after the taper announcement, out of thin air. From my vantage point, our money system is now being run in a way that is guaranteed to shred our narrative. And by the way, a nation's money is a social contract, and it's being tinkered with at this point in time. And so I completely understand that, you know, this is not a time to be scared. We need to be active. And for people who can look at this as a really potentially interesting moment in history to be alive, I like that framing. Still, how should we be active, do you think, at this point in time, and how do we go about really getting that critical mass that we need so that we can be successful like people have in times past?
Every cell in the body is programmed to do that which would be its highest service, as well as collaborating with other cells to work together to be of highest service to the healthy functioning of the whole. And I think in our hearts and in our minds and our conscience, in our deepest places, we each are programmed, and we each are called to the way that we ourselves can be best of service. I have felt it in terms of running for office, because I do think we need to run candidates on this message. You have felt it in terms of your website and your group, and you have felt it in terms of interviewing me today. This is how a movement gets built. It's that each person contributes the part that they feel is their highest, best use, and collaborates with other people in such a way that they synergistically contribute more than either one could by themselves. That's how movement works.
You know, what's interesting to me is I noticed a shift over time that a lot of the people who would come to listen to economic talks and when I gave talks centered on economics, largely boomers. And over time, I started to really wonder where were the younger people in this. And with a number of years of inquiry, I discovered that it boils down to there's a real generational split going on here that I can summarize in a single sentence, which is that for a lot of the boomers, they have everything to lose if the status quo is shifted. And for a lot of the young people, they have nothing to gain by preserving the status quo. I'm, from my vantage point, seeing a real split in thinking. And I'm wondering, in the spirit of bringing our best and highest programming to service and collaborating, have you looked at this, the way the generations are looking at this and how we can begin to work together on this?
Well, I think it's a fascinating construct that you described, and I'm sure it's true. You know, we do have, particularly in the millennial generation, a group that is willing, in a way that I find very healthy, to repudiate the status quo. On that, I think, you know, that's one of the best things that's happened in America in a long time. I wouldn't say the problem, but I think a challenge right now is that the polls show that while they are the most activistic in a long time and the most willing to repudiate the status quo in a long time, they also leave out of their formula often electoral politics. And I think that electoral politics is an important part of how this change is going to occur. You know, if we only have a sidebar conversation, if we only have a conversation going on in terms of private sector, even the nonprofit private sector, then I don't think that we will be able to get to the gist of the problem. And that's why I hope that we can turn electoral politics into a kind of more modern pursuit. I see this in my own campaign. You know, if you talk to the Washington guys and to the East Coast guys, just in the way they go about the technology, the way they go about the sort of aesthetic of campaigns, I understand why younger people wouldn't respond. It's like they're stuck in the 90s at best. So I'm living that conundrum right now, in that we really have to claim politics for the truth of who we are today. And I think in some ways young people are the ones who will recreate that field. But one of the things that I think is our job is reminding them that politics, traditional electoral politics, does matter, and that the kinds of changes we want to make will not happen without including electoral political campaigns in the formula.
I completely agree on a number of levels. I do sympathize with those who feel that politics as it's currently practiced doesn't quite have a vision that captures them, or worse, they're cynical and believe that the system will militate against them, if I could use that word. And I saw that with when I went down when Occupy Wall Street was first happening, and here were all these bright, shiny young people in classic form, full of energy, maybe not with a single point of focus, all over the map, but great energy. And I was down at Zuccotti Park, and it was completely rimmed with the latest Department of Homeland Security hardware. There were face recognition cameras on stocks. There were police everywhere. And so the response, I feel, in our country has become hostile to any changes. And I'm certainly sure that message was well received by all the progressive groups that have been recently infiltrated by a variety of acronym sort of organizations from the government. And it really feels like there's a antibody response to anybody who really wants to bring change. Harkening back to this is just how these things happen in history, is that how you see this gearing up, that it is time for us to step into the fray? This might get interesting, and it's time to go forward?
Well, I think that the point you just made harkens back to one I made a few minutes ago about the psychological factor. I mean, that's very, very dangerous for democracy, what you said. Healthy protest is the lifeblood, or the capacity, the permission to healthy protest, is the lifeblood of a democracy. I mean, if freedom does not include the freedom for the reasonable guarantee that you can gather in group protest and it be safe, and a safe place for you to go for you and your children, then, you know, it's like you were saying before about other people, by the people, for the people. We are currently mocking the Gettysburg Address. We are a government of a few of the people, by a few of the people, and for a few of the people. And if Lincoln said that a government of the people, by the people, for the people would not perish from the earth, it's already perishing. Now, not only does of the people, by the people, for the people, because we were talking earlier about you can't disconnect the economics from the civil liberties. If you're talking about what you're talking about now, which is what you just described, that to show up at an Occupy protest meant you were surrounded by SWAT teams with the kind of technology that they had and the kind of stories that we've all heard from Amy Goodman and others, then our democracy is in serious trouble. Those of us who are old enough remember a time when this was not true. I'm not saying that Vietnam protesters were not, you know, were not looked at and that their leaders were not harassed, but there wasn't what there is now. And I think what concerns me sometimes with young people is that they do not remember a time when it wasn't this way. And so, once again, the psychological factor, too many people are becoming inured to transgressions against our civil liberties. Take the NSA spying. If you have a newspaper report where the NSA spying is put right next to an article about Kim Kardashian's wedding dress, and you're not from a generation that would guffaw at that, that's what you were brought up with. Because you don't remember a time before the Telecommunications Act in 1996, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know, and that is what concerns me now. And once again, it's a psychological issue. So we're losing our healthy sense of protest. That's why even though the Tea Party, for the most part, represents political views that are diametrically opposed to mine, I appreciate and celebrate their revolutionary spirit. They're like, we're not going to take this anymore. Because some of that spirit, I think we need today.
Well, we need that spirit, and something else that I feel is, from my vantage point, seems to be missing is the spirit of compromise. We saw the Washington shutdown over some relatively minor amounts, budgetary amounts. And in truth, you brought back a very important point, which is that young people today may not have the institutional or residential memory of how things could be different. Pretty much everybody in Washington today has been alive during a time when we've been spending more than we've been taking in. And I think that's fostered a relative lack of ability to compromise. I think those are skills. And so I'm wondering if you're elected, how would you approach compromise? Because I think Washington's all about compromise, although they've lost it on some important topics.
Well, I think politics is about compromise. I think there is a philosophical vision in life with which you do not compromise, but when it comes to politics, you must compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think an unwillingness to compromise is beneath the professional minimum standard that should be accepted of any person in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And there are places where you hold a line, absolutely. But what we have are many people in Congress today for whom everything is to them a matter of non-negotiable ideological principle. Now, such as whatever Obama wants, we don't want, would be the view that many people would have. And this Congress has actually demonstrated that. Anything the president wants, even if it's something which in the past we ourselves proposed, we will be against on principle. The whole system breaks down when you have that kind of an attitude. So I certainly understand how important it is to compromise, not with my beliefs, not with my principles, but at certain times, absolutely, in terms of legislation. President Eisenhower said the American mind at its best is both liberal and conservative.
Mm.
And I think that's true. There's a yin and yang there. There is a drive to conserve those things which are eternally true and to insist on a level of personal accountability that needs to be balanced with a more liberal view of answering to immediate circumstances in a flexible way, along with a concern for the common good that would make sure that the certain people were taken care of, because such as children or the disabled or veterans or whatever, because they deserve to be. So I think that a certain level of balance and compromise, any of us who have been in an intimate relationship, this is part of whether you're two people in relationship or two huge political forces in relationship. learning to hear the other person, to recognize that no one has a monopoly on truth, and to learn from other people, and to build compromise from that place is actually a creative act, and it should be central to our political system.
Well, very well said. I have to ask, how's your campaign going?
Going well. It's going well in that I am going all over my district, talking to people who I think are very enthusiastic, a lot of times because of the very things that you and I are talking about, who realize that the kind of conversation that I have been having about the money, the way money now dominates our politics in a way that is unhealthy and undemocratic, the fact that looking to the political status quo to deliver us from that situation is unreasonable, given the fact that they created that situation. The idea that if we had enough independent voices, even 18 or so, in Congress, that would break the gridlock. People understanding about the two-party duopoly, understanding that that is an aberration and not a tradition in American politics. Educating people in some cases. I think a lot of people do not realize some of the unbelievable, unnecessary amounts of human suffering that have resulted from this financial lock and chokehold of a very small sector of our society.
Yep.
Whether it has to do with children living in poverty or our high mass incarceration rate. People understanding a little more about why it would be a good idea to audit the Fed. So the excitement that I feel and the support I feel and the enthusiasm I feel is very heartening. Now, you know, the question is, how will I be able to create a campaign that is able to be competitive against the institutional forces that will be arrayed against us? And that remains to be seen. I'm doing everything I can to create a campaign that can and will do that. It's early in the game, but not that early. And all I can tell you is I'm trying. I'm feeling hopeful. I'm certainly reading a lot of enthusiasm from people, and hopefully I will be able to turn that into an electoral victory. We'll see.
Well, fantastic. So if people wanted to support you, how would they do that?
Congress.com. I would appreciate any support people feel moved to give. You know, this is a grassroots campaign. I will not be receiving money from pharmaceutical companies and telecommunications companies like others running. So, you know, even $5 a month is a big help, and that's how people can do it. MarianneForCongress.com, and also put it on your Facebook, put it on your Twitter, and, you know, just help me get the word out so people can know about the campaign. I'd be very grateful.
Well, fantastic. Marianne Williamson, thank you so much for your time today. We desperately need people like you in power who are not afraid to speak truth to power, and we need our country headed in a new direction, or a whole new set of directions. I wish you the best of luck in the next election and in all the years that follow.
Thank you, and right back at you. All my best, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.